The last case in our calendar is 09-1144, Disciplinary Counsel versus Justin Martius Smith. Mr. Koblentz.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Richard S. Koblentz, and firstly, I would ask to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if that would be agreeable with the court. I appear here today representing Justin Smith, but realistically, Your Honors, I have the honor of representing every employed young attorney in the state of Ohio as we stand here today. Lawyers who work for law firms and work for sole practitioners. As this court is well aware, this matter was brought because of the timing of it under the old disciplinary rules rather than under the rules of professional conduct as they exist today. Had this matter been brought under the rules as they exist today, Mr. Smith would have been able to avail himself of a defense under Rule 5.2, which was not available to him under the old disciplinary rules, which would have given him the possibility of raising the safe harbor defense of following the reasonable dictates of his lawyer, of his employer. I'm in an interesting position today because unlike normally when I appear before this honorable court, there is really no question as to sanction. My opponent has agreed that the sanction proposed by the Board of Commissioners is appropriate. However, we are here on a matter of guilt. I firmly believe, and I believe the evidence calls for, a dismissal by this court. When we deal with the old rules, we are in a situation where the idea of sending a message, as indicated by my opponent, just simply is not appropriate in these situations.
Was Mr. Chapman ever pursued? Was a complaint ever filed against Mr. Chapman?
No, Your Honor, and in fact, we moved, as the court's well aware, under Rule 5, the civil rules govern these procedures. Mr. Chapman was not named, and we filed a motion with the board to join Mr. Chapman as a necessary party to this litigation, which motion was overruled by the panel.
So your basic defense is my boss made me do it.
My basic defense is that I was working for my boss. It was his decision. If you look at the words of DR 2106, it says you cannot charge, attempt to charge, or collect an excessive or illegal fee.
Did Mr. Chapman prevent him from doing any research on PIP New York law?
Mr. Chapman told him he was handling the research himself, as the record indicates, and that he had gotten good advice from other people that the money shouldn't, that the contract was valid and the firm was entitled to the money. Additionally, Your Honor, when Mr. Chapman was confronted by his legal malpractice attorney, Mr. Cetullo, as the record reflects, Mr. Cetullo advised Mr. Chapman, once he had looked at the law, to immediately disgorge the fees, and Mr. Chapman refused to do that. Mr. Chapman did agree to put the money into escrow, but would not allow the money to be returned to the clients absent a release. Mr. Smith had absolutely no control over that, Your Honor.
Well, are you saying that he never had, I mean, in order for the fact that, you know, the boss was calling the shots and he was just proceeding according to orders, did he have the inkling at any point that this was not the correct method for securing these fees?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. If you read the record, he confronted Mr. Chapman, and we brought in corroborating witnesses from the law firm.
Exactly, but he continued along this course of conduct in spite of his misgivings that this was what should be appropriate, correct?
Well, he didn't continue along the course of conduct. All he did was act as a scrivener. It is any more than a secretary would have to draft a letter. It wasn't a matter of continuing along a course of conduct. He had no control over the money. The checks were payable to the Chapman Law Firm. They went to the Chapman Law Firm accounts. What Mr. Smith did was write the letter at Mr. Chapman's order.
And who signed the letter?
I believe Mr. Smith signed the letter at Mr. Chapman's
order. And he
order.
Was the attorney of record with these clients, correct?
Well, he was the attorney who signed the case up. The contract was with the Chapman Law Firm.
But he was the attorney for the plaintiffs here.
Yes. I mean, he acted as their counsel in his role as an associate attorney in the Chapman Law Firm. However, the contract was with the Chapman Law Firm. Had Mr. Smith left the law firm, the Chapman Law Firm would have continued with the case.
I guess I understand that. But my concern here is at what point, how severe does the knowledge of wrongdoing or suspected wrongdoing or acting contrary to the canons have to be before it becomes someone in Mr. Smith's position's responsibility as opposed to his employer. What duty did Mr. Smith have here?
Well, first, Your Honor, with all due respect, I can't accept the predicate that Mr. Smith violated the canons.
Well, all right, what duty did he have?
I believe he had a duty to do exactly what he did, which is try to raise his concerns up to his employer, to advocate on behalf of the Riegers. However, he had no control over this. I mean, no matter what he would have done, this wouldn't have changed. Well, he had no control whatsoever.
He would have gone to the clients and said, I don't think you're being charged appropriately?
What would have happened is exactly what did happen, is they went to another lawyer and they filed a lawsuit, and they got their money. That is what they did do. They were compensated through the vehicle of the legal malpractice case.
And isn't that the right thing to do, to say, my boss is telling me to do something that cheats you out of $80,000, so I wouldn't stay with our firm because this is unethical? You keep saying he got the maximum benefit for his client in your briefs. $80,000 in fees they took they weren't entitled to is not a maximum benefit recovery for the client.
Well, the maximum benefit we allude to throughout the briefing, Your Honor, is the recovery. Okay, there could have been no more money recovered from the insurance entities than was recovered.
Except
that's
that
the
they took a big hunk of the fee they weren't entitled to. That's not getting a maximum recovery.
Again, Your Honor, I can't accept the predicate that they got the fee. Mr. Chapman took the fee. He had the contract. I think that the situation is such that if we want to set up a quasi-criminal area with vicarious liability, obviously this court has the right to do that. This court has the right to set whatever rules it wants to under the Ohio Constitution.
Let me take it to page 11, Mr. Koblentz, of the relator's brief. As you know, there seems to be a dispute over who prepared the disbursement sheet and who was responsible for that. From your brief, I got the impression that you believe that Mr. Chapman prepared the fee disbursement, or disbursement sheet of how the settlement and the it says the relator says, I'm just questioning this veracity of this. Respondent testified that he prepared all the disbursement sheets and the letters explaining the disbursement. The client's prospective respondent was their attorney. Is that accurate? Is that not accurate?
He prepared them in his role as a scrivener at Mr. Chapman's order said, this is what you lay out there. He did lay out the letter themselves. It was not the concept. He was in no different situation than if a secretary had followed along with Mr. Chapman's orders.
But the secretary doesn't have ethical duties directly to a client. His ethical duty is not to Mr. Chapman. It's to his client. That's the problem I'm having with your argument.
I understand that, Your Honor. However, Mr. Chapman assured him, as the record shows, that he had checked with other people and this was the right way to do it. He had misgivings about it. He didn't agree with it. And I think that, to call him up for professional discipline and to mark his career, to mark his life, professional life for the rest of his life, by having his name on the website here with the disciplinary history, malpractice concerns, what happens in the realistic point of what a disciplinary sanction does to somebody, I think really has to be recognized. Also, I think we have to take into account that we do have a duty to take a look at young lawyers in this system. I'm not advocating for Mr. Chapman. I don't think what he did was right at all. We stipulated the fee was excessive.
Mr. Koblentz, your client never undertook any research on whether it was permissible to take a fee, whether it's PIP coverage or any research on the choice of law. Never contacted any New York lawyer? I mean, didn't he have any responsibility at all?
Mr. Chapman told him he was doing that, sir. And Mr. Chapman told him he had done that and he had the answers.
So this appears to be, whatever Mr. Chapman says, I'm going to do it regardless of my independent thought. I have no personal responsibility here, no professional responsibility?
Well, Your Honor, we're talking about a matter of setting a legal fee. We're not talking about doing something that was dishonest. We're not talking about lying. We're not talking about any of the other items that show up in any of the cases that were cited by our opponent.
He was the lawyer.
He was the lawyer for these people. His superior told him that I have checked this out. The fee, in the testimony was from the expert, retained by the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, that there was nothing wrong with the contract. It was a perfectly valid contract. It was a good contract. It was the matter in which it was applied. His employer, who was his superior, told him, I'm checking that out. I've talked to lawyers in these jurisdictions. What we're doing is appropriate. Now, if we want to set up a situation where we take young men, young women out of law school, tell them go out and get a job, and then set them up with a trap that if you listen to your employer, you're going to be professionally sanctioned, and marked for the rest of your life, obviously this court has the right to do that. I just don't think it's fair. I don't think that the burden of proof was met here. If we just look at the language of the rules, Mr. Smith didn't charge this fee. He didn't attempt to charge this fee. He didn't collect it. No. And as far as the neglect is concerned, the idea of saying that, especially in view of the fact that Mr. Chapman, we know, ignored Mr. Satullo's.
Well, was he handling a matter then that was beyond his level of expertise and shouldn't have been engaged in that field or in that type of representation?
In view of the fact that he obtained the maximum recovery for the client, Your Honor, I don't know how anybody could make that contention. Now, to say that he should have been aware of New York law, Mr. Satullo testified that he went back and researched New York law when he got retained by the insurance carrier on the legal malpractice matter. At that point, Mr. Satullo did that, gave Mr. Chapman the advice, and Mr. Chapman, who was the man holding the money, said no. So even had Mr. Smith done that, he'd still be here because Mr. Chapman wouldn't have listened to him. I don't know what else he could have done, but if we look at what the burdens of proof
Counsel,
are.
Counsel, could I ask a couple questions here? I think at least some of us can appreciate the fact that a young lawyer is in a firm with apparently a very dominating personality. But I think what is troubling is that, in fact, you stated it, he didn't have any more responsibility than a secretary or a billing clerk. And I think that is a little troubling. Just a couple clarification questions. Was he on a straight salary with the Chapman Law Office?
Your Honor, his salary was $32,000 a year, and he was given a bonus based upon his production.
Okay, so the higher the fee, he would benefit in some degree from that?
That is correct, although he did advocate against it.
Okay, and the billing itself was sent under his cover letter as opposed to a bill directly from the Chapman Law Office?
There was no bill, Your Honor. This was a personal injury matter. So the monies were received by the Chapman firm. They sent a disbursement sheet out, and they sent what I will freely admit was a very lower amount of compensation to the clients than they should have gotten, but that went out on a Chapman check under Chapman letterhead.
Okay, so he didn't sign that at all, a cover letter or anything?
I think he signed. I believe he signed the cover letter.
Okay, so.
But he was told by his employer, this is what you will do. I think if we want to tell young lawyers that they ought to quit their jobs and not be able to pay their mortgages, we should have something like that in the way we teach our young lawyers.
But the contrary argument to that is, what message do we send to young lawyers in these sort of situations if we dismiss this claim?
I think the message that you send to them, first of all, we've already sent them a message under Rule 5.2. The laws have changed. I remember having a conversation with Justice O'Donnell about 3 years ago about how things were going to be different with this system as we're going to operate under two sets of laws for a period of time. That's what we're doing right here. I went out and researched this and saw whether or not it would be appropriate to try to raise the new law as a defense. And in all candor, I couldn't find any authority that would have allowed us to raise that 5.2 safe harbor defense under a claim brought under the Code of Professional Responsibility. Therefore, we didn't bring it. However, the message we've now sent by the new rules under Rule 5.2 is that a junior lawyer or subordinate lawyer can rely on the reasonable dictates of the superior. Under the scenario, while I believe the fee was excessive, but let's take into context the fact that I've been practicing law over 30 years. Mr. Smith was a two-year lawyer at that point. I believe the fee was excessive. I saw it right away. I don't necessarily graft my knowledge and my experience onto a young man who just got out of law school. I've learned a little bit over the last
year. Well, counsel, not only, and I know this is nowhere near as serious as some of the other allegations of your client's performance, but doing things as simple as placing, power of attorney and signing the names of these individuals and really not being their power of attorney or even having a power of attorney in existence. Are you saying he did that because his employer informed he needed to do that?
That was the way that things were done in that office, and this is a young man.
Wait. That's the way things were done in the office. Even a law student knows that you don't do that kind of, you don't notarize something that is not done in your presence, this power of attorney. signature signing to misrepresent on documents, that's not something that you can say my employer told me to do it, therefore I breached what I learned in my ethics classes and I did it? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, first of all, I'm going to tell you that they don't teach that in the ethics class. That's something I will tell you. The practical things that we need to know aren't taught in the law school ethics classes, and frankly, we need mentoring programs. And unfortunately, some lawyers get out of law school and they don't get the right mentors. And I'm not saying Frank Chapman was the right one. He was the wrong one. But to besmirch and taint Justin Smith for the rest of his life because of something somebody else did, in all candor, Your Honors, that's just wrong. And I realize I'm out of time. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to appear here today on behalf of Mr. Smith and on behalf of all the young lawyers in Ohio.
Thank you, Mr. Koblentz. Ms. Hissom. First question, Ms. Hissom, is that this seems to cry out for the question. And you, if you cannot answer this question, that's a sufficient answer. Mr. Chapman seems to be, the finger seems to be pointing at Mr. Chapman. Our understanding is that there's been nothing filed against him, and I know there's obviously there are confidentiality issues. Can you help us at all with understanding? He didn't even testify, apparently, at the hearing. Can you enlighten us at all? If you cannot, that's an acceptable answer.
What I can tell you without breaching the confidentiality of our office is that we are aware of Mr. Chapman and his activities in this case. But I will also tell you what is public, and that is that Mr. Chapman currently does not reside in the state of Ohio also.
Thank you.
To start, good morning, Your Honors. My name is Heather Hissom. I'm here on behalf of Relator, the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. In this case, the board found clear and convincing evidence that respondent violated two disciplinary rules, DR2-106A and DR6-101A1. The board recommended that respondent receive a public reprimand for these two violations. Relator would ask this court to uphold both the board's finding of the violations and the recommended sanction.
Do those violations relate to the power of attorney and the signing of the client's name on the checks?
In part, yes, because of DR6101A1, which is handling a matter beyond his responsibility. There were a lot of different facts that went with that violation. One of them entailed signing of the checks with the power of attorney, which there was testimony on at the hearing. Respondent violated DR2106A by charging a fee of 40% on personal injury protection or PIP benefits that he was not legally entitled to charge. PIP benefits are no-fault benefits paid directly to medical providers. They are obtained by filling out a form and submitting it to the insurance company. These benefits were never in the possession of the respondent or his firm. New York, the state where the Riegers, who are the clients, live, and where the policy originated, prohibits the taking of attorney fees on these benefits. Because respondent conducted no research into the PIP coverage, did not research New York law, did not associate or talk with attorneys from New York, and testified that he relied only on Chapman to find out this information, the board found that respondent violated DR6-101A1, specifically stating that respondent's lack of research left him unable to advocate for his clients when it came to the fees. Respondent believed that the only duty he owed his clients was to get them the maximum settlement that he could. Respondent did not believe that he has any other duty to his clients, even when that recovery was nearly dissipated by the fees that were charged. Respondent repeatedly testified at the hearing that he relied on what he was told by others. He testified that any decisions regarding the fees were not his responsibility, and because of this, he did not research the propriety of taking fees on the personal injury protection benefits. In fact, respondent did not even learn that attorney fees were illegal to take on PIP benefits until Nick Cetullo, the attorney in the malpractice case, told him after they were sued by the clients. Despite the vehement arguments of counsel here today, respondent directly participated in charging the attorney fees to his clients. Respondent prepared three separate disbursement sheets, all of which took fees on the PIP at 40%.
You know, Mr. Koblentz says those were prepared at the direction of Mr. Chapman. I guess what I'd like to have us do here is maybe clarify us, because I'm not clear at all, and the record we haven't read yet, but which of Mr. Smith's actions were his actions, his volition, not under the direction of Mr. Chapman, and which were under the direction of Mr. Chapman? Start with the disbursement sheet. I think we seem to have a difference of opinion here about whether he prepared that because it was they were his clients and he prepared the fee agreement. Did Mr. Chapman tell him how to prepare it seemed to me that there is some indication that he did. Mr. Chapman did tell Mr. Smith how to prepare the disbursement sheets.
I think the best way to answer that is talk about the three disbursement sheets maybe, because the circumstances of each were a little bit different. The first disbursement sheet, which was sent in December of 2003, was only sent to Florence Rieger, which is one of the clients, and discussed her portion of the settlement and her fee. That did take the fee at 40% on both the PIP benefits and the GEICO coverage, but also stated that she was to receive a check in the amount of $34,839 for her portion of the settlement. She never received this. Respondent testified at the hearing that he didn't have an actual, what he would consider, or what he stated was a conversation about the fees with Chapman until he was doing the second disbursement sheet, which was in September of 2004. That is the disbursement sheet that combined the recovery for both Lewis and Florence Rieger, contained the PIP benefits, the GEICO coverage, and took all of their expenses as one. That is when, by doing two separate sheets, the respondent realized that by treating them as two separate clients and taking the fee at 40%, Lewis Rieger would actually owe the firm $10,000 in attorney fees. He took those to Chapman, and what respondent testified was that Chapman told him to make it work. By making it work, what respondent did was create one disbursement sheet, treating two separate clients as one. So basically, the extra fees were taken from the from Florence's recovery.
Yeah, the make it work was, as I understand, make it work was to diminish the liability of the clients for the fees. Isn't that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Because by treating them as separate clients, one of the clients would actually owe fees after the 40% was taken. There was a third disbursement sheet that occurred in February of the following year, and that was the basis of the fact that when the respondent prepared the September disbursement sheet, there was an error in taking the subrogation claim. It was actually not taken off the top, and so there were attorney's fees taken on the $6,000 that actually went back to the insurance company, if I'm explaining it correctly. And so an additional $2,400 was sent to the clients at that time. But I think it's important to notice
and
that—
And who discovered that error? Did the respondent testify he did or Mr. Chapman did?
Actually, that error was discovered after Relator sent a letter of inquiry to Mr. Smith after we received the grievance.
You said that Mr. Smith took the disbursement sheets to, I guess it was the second one, to Mr. Chapman. That suggests to me that Mr. Smith prepared these on his own or what? I mean, he took them to Mr. Chapman for approval, I guess.
He took them to Mr. Chapman to show what happened if the clients were treated separately with the 40% fees. The only, what respondent testified to as truly serious conversation he had about the fees with Mr. Chapman occurred in late September or early October. With that second disbursement sheet where the two clients are treated as one, they received as their total disbursement $8,207 and were sent a check in that amount. Their son, the Rieger son, contacted Mr. Smith to dispute the fact that that was all that his parents received out of a $200,000 recovery. And specifically, their son disputed the amount of fees that were taken. Respondent testified at the hearing that he went back to Chapman, told him of this telephone call, and told him, Chapman, that the clients were unhappy about the fees. But there is no testimony as to how that was handled. I mean, I think respondent believed that Chapman would handle it or they just let it go. But respondent did testify that after that telephone call from the client's son, he had no further contact with the clients until they were sued.
Is there a reason, I assume there is a reason, that we should know why Mr. Chapman didn't testify, either by deposition or at the hearing? Was he out of the state then when the hearing was held?
He has been out of state for some time.
So he wasn't available, I guess. Is that, it would have been nice to have his testimony, wouldn't it?
We did not call him.
Would have been helpful, I guess, his testimony.
Counsel, with respect to the client, from the beginning, with whom did they deal in terms of solving their claims that they had?
The clients only ever dealt with Mr. Smith, with the respondent in this case. They never dealt with Mr. Chapman.
So in terms of putting yourself in their shoes, Mr. Smith was their lawyer.
Mr. Smith was their lawyer. From start to finish. They, respondent actually testified at the hearing that he had multiple conversations with not just the clients, but with their children, that he was in constant contact with them discussing their case. So he was, for all intents and purposes,
He's the one that hired the investigator to make sure that the tortfeasor didn't have any other assets to go against, be over and above the insurance.
That is correct. That's a decision that respondent made.
Right.
Did respondent make the decision to apply the 40% to the New York recovery, even though their contract that he had the client sign required 40% only if suit was filed, and suit was never filed?
Actually, suit was filed in this case. The respondent became the attorney of the Riegers in May of 2002. He filed suit in September of 2002. That lawsuit named only one defendant, and that is the actual driver of the vehicle, the tortfeasor. It did not name either that tortfeasor's insurance company. It didn't name State Farm, which is where the PIP benefits came from. It didn't name John Doe's or an underinsured claim. It named only that tortfeasor.
Did he testify that was the basis of which he justified taking 40% against the New York claim?
Yes, he testified that the way that he read the contract was that the 40% was after suit was filed, that the contract did not say on the party against whom the suit was filed.
If I read the record correct, did the hospital make a direct claim against State Farm and the payment was directly to the hospital and it did not pass through the Chapman firm?
For all of the PIP benefits for both Lewis and Florence, they went directly to the hospitals. But you are correct. Cleveland Metro Health Hospital, which is where Lewis was, made a direct claim against State Farm for the PIP benefits, and they received $175,000 directly from the insurance company.
Was Mr. Smith at all involved in making sure that the PIP benefits were paid?
He made also an application for Lewis. He made the only application for Florence.
Because these insurance companies don't just throw the money over the transom, do they? Somebody has to tell them this is a legitimate claim and you owe it.
Sorry, excuse me. Actually, the way that the no-fault PIP benefits work for New York law, there is literally a one-page front and back form, and it's an exhibit in the record. Both of the forms are exhibits in the record where it's basically name, address,
okay, but
injuries, that type of thing, and it's sent to the insurance company.
He left State Farm know, I'm their attorney, you owe this to the hospitals.
He did fill out forms,
right.
One for each.
All right.
Well, I thought the one hospital already filed their own form. Usually works, or at least works for one of the hospitals. They didn't wait for the lawyer to get involved. They sent their own form in.
Correct. Cleveland Metro Health actually
they
did their
really
own form
need
first.
His form, although he didn't know that, I guess. So
he did not know that at the time.
Ms. Hissom, the argument that Mr. Koblenz presents us with is that had this occurred subsequently, there would be a safe harbor provision that he would be able to avail himself of. Would that completely exonerate any finding in an instance like this, in your view, or would it moderate what a punishment might be?
Your Honor, it would not create a complete safe harbor where he would not have any responsibility in this matter at all. If one looks at Rule 5.2, the first paragraph of Rule 5.2 states that this rule does not alleviate the responsibility of an attorney to file the Ohio Rules of Professional Conduct. And the second part of the rule states that there has to be an attempt at a reasonable resolution of an ethical issue to create the defense. In this case, we do not have any testimony or evidence that the respondent actually went to Chapman and said, I think this is an ethical problem. I think that we are charging an excessive fee. I think we are, you know, opening up ourselves to some liability ethically in this matter, and we need to try to find some way to deal with that by either reducing the fee or giving it back. There is no evidence that that was ever brought up by the respondent in this matter.
There were some other cases that the board referred to. I think both Johnson and Sawyers. Are you satisfied that if we were to affirm or agree that this is a public reprimand, do you feel that this is in conjunction with cases that we've had in the past?
After reading the board report and reviewing the cases cited by the board in this matter, we believe that it's an appropriate discipline for this case.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hism. Mr. Koblenz, you've used your time, which may take 30 seconds.
Very quickly, Your Honor, just several things. First off, I would like everybody sitting on this panel to put themselves back in the position they were in 2 years after they left law school and ask themselves what they would have done and if they should have been subjected to professional discipline with what they knew at that time. Secondly, I would implore some of the questions I listened to, please read the record. There's a standard here. It's clear and convincing evidence. We believe if you read the record and you read the language of the rules, there is no question but that this matter appropriately should be dismissed. Thank you very much.
Counsel, before you sit down, when did your client cease working for Mr. Chapman?
The Chapman Law Firm went out of business, Your Honor. I want to say 2007. I'm not sure. What happened was Mr. Chapman, the firm rolled into one that had a major contract with Housing and Urban Development. When Mr. Chapman lost that contract, he made a lot of money. He retired, closed the law firm up, and my client had to go out and hang a shingle.
Counsel, I think maybe you demean every recent graduate of law school. What was the net check that these people got out of the 200,000? Was it 200,000?
I believe that the net check that they got, I believe that Ms. Hism got it out. It was somewhere over somewhere between $7,000 and $8,000. I'm not sure exactly.
How much?
Between $7,000 and $8,000.
$7,000 and $8,000.
And we admitted
out of 200.
We admitted that that was excessive.
Well, I think most recent law graduates would be a little troubled by that.
And he was very troubled, Your Honor. And the evidence, if you read the record, he did fight with him. Did he use the word ethics? No. Did he use the word disciplinary system? No. Did he say it's too much money? Yes. And frankly, when we wanted to get him in and talk about his conversations directly, Ms. Hism appropriately objected, and that was sustained as hearsay.
I mean, wouldn't you be troubled enough to say, I'm not doing it? If this is what's happening, you're doing it.
He did do it. I mean, he did it because he got the money. He was not in a position that he said, and very frankly, did he say, if you do this, I quit? No, he didn't.
So he continued to work with him, Mr. Chapman, for five more years. He graduated in 2000. This happened in 2002, and you say that he worked there till 2007.
Approximately, that's correct, Your Honor.
So he wasn't truly that disturbed about the practices within the office?
No, that isn't true. He was very disturbed. He needed a job. It's a rough employment system out there. And I don't believe he should be held liable because he needed work.
Thank you, Mr. Koblenz.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.